This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Australia Audio proudly presents The Drover's Wife, The Legend of Molly Johnson. Written by Leah Purcell, narrated by Leah Purcell. All rights reserved. For Bane, with all my love. Prelude, 1913. I love the snow gum. It's stout, drunk, strong. Beautiful coloured patterns appear when wet, a gift from God. The sturdy tree's limbs outstretched, waiting to take the weight of winter. The weight of you. Oh, to see these trees after an autumn shower. It's this rare beauty that reminds me why I stay. Late one evening, Daniel Johnson sits alone on the veranda of a newly renovated homestead, reading from a tatty notebook, his lantern light low. The notebook is 16 years old now, a collection of sketches, poems, and memories. He knew he had to put it all down somehow. From the moment that spurred the four of them, Danny, Joe Jr., Henry James, and Little Delphi, to run into the mountains to be with them, and everything he learnt in those short 4 years. Their knowledge ancient beyond comprehension, and there was only so much they could share. Time and society were against them. Now a man of 32 years, Danny flicks through the notebook, and the images he sketched look as though they are animated. He stops on a page that features a full moon, the many rings he's drawn representing the moon's larger-than-normal halo of light, a powerful glow and energy bringing unrest to the land. Danny's thoughts race back to the moment that was the inspiration for his poem. It was suggested by her, Louisa. Write a poem, perhaps. A way to ease the pain, the hurt and the loss. You don't have to show it to anyone or share it. It's just for you, Danny. He was taught to write poetry by Mrs. Louisa Clintoff, a newspaper proprietor, a friend, a long time ago now. This poem grew from a time he remembers well, too well. The harrowing moments he has kept to himself, never shared before, not even with his siblings. It's his job to protect them, even now they're all grown. Contained between the pages of the old notebook is the story of a great woman, strong, steadfast, reliable, and loving. His ma, Molly Johnson, Nee Stewart, daughter of Jock Stewart, Scotsman and jack of all trades. It's the story of a mother's love fierce and true, and of a black man who was noble, wise and gentle, a warrior of ancient proportions, but unfortunately not Danny's father. Memories of cautious meetings, bonding and the sharing of stories. Lessons were learnt and a mutual understanding and genuine respect developed from the man to the boy and from the boy to the man, Yarika and Daniel Johnson. There were exchanges around the fire pit, but Yarika's stay was short. The full moon was to guide him away, north, back home to his mother's country. But that first winter's full moon night became momentous in more ways than one. Chapter 1, 1893, late May, a few hours before midnight. I'm dead, thinks the badly beaten Molly Johnson, who lies foxing on the ground. Her bloodshot eyes dart back and forth as she gathers her thoughts. What should I do next? Her heavy breathing makes the loose sod under her bleeding nose and swollen lips spray. She'd heard that when death is inevitable, life flashes before your eyes. Well, to hell with that, thinks Molly. I have my children to live for. She knows she must bide her time. Firstly, for herself, to regain some strength and think on her next course of action. Because she is no match for these two bastard stockmen. A strong cuss word crosses her mind that she would love to call them, scream to the world. But only the majestic mountain range in front of her two-room shanty will hear and echo the word back, slapping her fair in her battered face. And there is no one here who cares for her opinion. She's just a woman. A moon, large and full with many glowing rings, sits high in the night sky, silver beams spilling down to spotlight the front yard of Molly's home. Large boulders sit behind the hut and sparsely placed white sallies border the perimeter, their trunks shimmering in the moonlight, the shanty hidden in the bush to protect or hinder. Molly cautiously lifts her head just enough to see the two stockmen as they catch their breath. The one who looks like a boy in physique wears an oilskin coat and a woman's petticoat skirt over his breeches. He takes a rope from his belt. Pulled down low, his hat casts a shadow over his face. He ties up the legs of an unconscious man who lies behind the tree trunk log that sits next to the fire pit. Ever so slightly, Molly tilts her head to see the other stockman who did all the hitting. He's helping himself to her water barrel, the barrel that she and the children fill, walking the dangerously steep decline to the banks of the Murrumbidgee and back again. He's built like a bullock, and every bone in her body aches with pain, especially her head. But pain is not new to her. She has felt wrath before and is hardened to it, and that just may be her undoing tonight. The older stockman with the full red beard coughs, water spluttering from his mouth. The droplets on his beard sparkle like diamonds in the moonlight. "Choke on it, you bastard," she thinks. The distaste for him makes Molly want to spit. Or is it the blood pooling in her mouth? "Fuck," she thinks as she lowers her head. She really could be done for here. Then, there before her, she sees her axe, large, menacing and sharp. It lies in the dirt beside the old chopping block, stained on one side with something that looks like blood. The younger stockman asks, "How many will he make?" pointing to the unseen man. 38. "Is that all? Slowing up in your old age." "I'm not getting paid." The older stockman pours the rest of the water over his face and it cascades down his beard. He takes the rope from his belt and begins to knot a noose. The knight sits in silence, anticipating for what's to come. From behind them comes a gut-wrenching, "Ah!" Molly has picked up the axe and with all her might tries to swing it with force. The stockmen spin on their heels to see her standing before them with the axe raised. She looks like a crazed woman, her hair wild and woolly like the thicket found in the high country, menacing and fierce, her stance wide. She swings the axe and the men scatter. The younger one runs, dropping the secured legs of the unconscious man heavily back onto the log. Molly grabs at her ribs as the axe hits the ground. Sharp pain rips through her upper body. Her ribs are broken. Her breath catches as she gasps with pain. She's angry that her attempt to connect with either of them has failed. "Oh, what the hell was I thinking?" She should have lain on the ground, pretended to have been knocked out, and hoped they left with just him, and took their revenge out on him. Not that she would wish that upon him, but if it was to save her life and save her being taken from her children, then so be it. Sometimes that's just how things are done here. In the middle of nowhere, in the alpine country of the snowy mountains. Every child needs their mother. Molly, feeling a fool, senses every aching part of her body, her swelling face, the red welt marks on her cheekbones, her throbbing jawline and her tender ribs. She tastes the salt of sweat and blood dribbling into her mouth as she sucks in air, exhausted and leaning on the axe for support now. Using all her strength, she tries to lift it again. Her effort is feeble and the two stockmen laugh at her. The one with the boyish physique bares his rotten teeth, snaring. Molly struggles to hold the axe up. Her breath runs shallow and rapid. The red-bearded stockman shifts his shotgun. "Put it down, or I'll put a bullet through you." Molly doesn't move. You're a fucking disgrace, woman. He indicates to the pants and boots of the tied-up unconscious man. The log by the fire pit obscures his upper body. Putting your life on the line for this lowlife. He spits the words at her in disgust. Molly's battered face is streaked with tears, running with her sweat, snot and blood. The younger stockman asks the other, "You gonna shoot her?" The older stockman takes his shooting stance. Molly knows she can't win. She steps forward. He's quick to cock his shotgun. The other raises his pistol. With an anguished, guttural yell, she brings the axe down hard into the chopping block. Iron to hard wood, sparks fly. She steps back, knowing her demise is near. The red beard lunges towards her. Molly cowers. "My children, please, my children!" She backs away and he grabs her by the arm, his dirty, hairy fist raised. Punch after punch, her head snapping back. He stops, releasing his hold. She drops. The younger stockman marches towards Molly, sprawled out on the ground. The tingling sensation starts in my feet. It is unconsciousness crawling, covering me, numbing me. My mind drifts, taking me far away from here, to fields of wild flowers. And there is my cute-as-a-button 5-year-old daughter. She hands me a flowered crown of wild daisies that matches the daisy necklace I wear around my neck. The laughter of my 3 sons behind me in the field of colourful wildflowers that beam so bright. They play fight. Fight. Fight in the dark that covers my mind like a blanket. Fight. I hear, fight, I hear myself say. Fight it I may, but the power in the stockman's punches is too much for me, and I am gone to the darkness. Before I lose consciousness, I hear a ripping sound, and I'm not sure if it is the cloth or my flesh. Further out front, beyond a protruding mound of the old wood heap, the ancient snow gum stands like a sentinel. Its stout trunk strong and curved like a woman's form in the moonlight, its sturdy limbs outstretched, waiting to take the weight of winter. Behind the snow gum, someone watches, crouching, unseen in the shadows, the full moon spotlighting the brutality before them. Chapter 2. 1 month earlier. We walk for miles on some Sundays, for no reason, knowing very well we will not see anyone. But we do it. We walk and we talk. Every second Sunday we put in our best, which is nothing fancier than what is worn for the rest of the week. Best described as rags, really. But our faces are washed, the boys' shirts pressed, Delphi's hair set, and Joe Jr. and Henry James still just fit their worn-out boots. Danny's barefoot. He's supposed to be getting his Dar's boots this winter. Danny is at that in-between age and stage of his growing, and the fact that he could be off to work next year with Droven, well, I shake my head at the prospect. My little boy's becoming a man. He turned 12, nearly 2 months back now. I can hold out for that day when Danny has to go off to work, but I really don't wish it to come at all. I need him around the house for at least another few years. Damn it, didn't think about what that would mean. He might have to. Things are tight. Tighter than normal with the economic depression hitting us hard out this way. Sheep industry almost gone. And this last drove, well, they brought 15,000 head down from Queensland and Joe, my husband by status only, no love lost on him, just for the children really, do I do the duty of a devoted wife. He and his usual droven mates meet them and take the sheep to the high country for 3 months, then bring them down just before the first snowfall in the high country, for the sale. That's been the pattern for nearly 8 years now. I don't know the men Joe works with. Not my business. I really don't care either. It's money, support, and I get to be alone with my children. Our happy time when he's away working, which is often. Danny takes his mother's hand and looks at her. She's a handsome woman with all the signs of 40 years of a hard life etched on her face. You're right, Ma? You're frowning a lot there. I look at him, my beautiful olive-skinned boy, blonde hair parted at the side, not perfectly, but he's attempted to groom himself in that boy way. Handsome young man he is. Gotta make someone a fine husband, this one. Just thinking about Alligator. Thought we might have seen him, I say, smiling. Danny looks at the scrub around us, longing for his faithful old mongrel dog to come bounding over. It's only been 2 weeks, Ma. He'll come back. Alligator and Danny were inseparable when Danny was a wee one. Danny was 3, an alligator a pup, full of fleas and mange. Crawled in from out behind the snow gum out front with his tail between his legs, he did. You could tell he'd been beaten. But we washed him in bush soap, wattle leaves, scrunched up. Add water makes a good sud. A gin showed me this when I was a little girl. Me and Dar was hiding in the scrub. Shh, quiet now, he whispered, putting his fingers to his lips. A tribe walked through, about 25 yards from us. Dar whistled and a gin stopped and looked around. She would have been in her mid-30s. She dropped something and then kept walking. About half an hour later, she returned. I vaguely remember her smiling at me. And then all I remember is her taking me to the river and washing me with the wattle leaves. Oh, I loved it. Foam and suds from leaves. I thought it was magic. We lathered the dog and then rubbed him down with goanna oil for the mange and a dab of eucalyptus at the back of his neck, hoping to keep the fleas away. And we fed him, and Danny loved him. And the dog got better. Danny named him Alligator. Well, that's what I thought he said. Alligator became Danny's protector. Well, all our protector, really. Danny likes to tell of the bravery of his dog, but his favourite story is the one about the time when that blasted copperhead found its way inside. If there's one thing I'm scared of out here, it is the copperhead snake, the last reptile to go into hibernation with a bite that kills. If either me or my kids get bit, we have no hope. See, that's why I trust no one with the stacking of my wood heap. Got a blackfella to do it once, and the bastard stacked it holler and a snake got in under. It crawled past Henry James sitting in the dirt playing. Not sure where Joe Jr. was. He couldn't have been too far. He and Henry James are pretty much two peas in a pod. Joe Jr.'s only 1 year older. But Danny gave chase with a stick bigger than himself. Get away, I yelled, pulling him back. The copperhead made its way inside. Alligator on its trail, barking and bouncing around. That night we managed to eat outside by the fire pit. But the children got tired, typical bush kids. As soon as the sun goes down, they're off to bed and they rise at first light. So I had to put them all up on the kitchen table out of harm's way to sleep. All night I sat watching, waiting for that bastard snake to come out. Made the night a living hell. Alligator lay at the threshold of the shanty, watching the shadows under the bed. Every now and then his hair would bristle and he would growl low, then nothing. I kept trying to think of a way to get the snake out. It was the beginning of winter, so maybe it was looking for its last feed. Oh, and then it hit me, food, of course. I remembered an old wives' tale. The same gin some years later had told me to be careful. Through hand and body actions, and with a little broken English now, she warned me, snakes can smell your tinyangan, your breast milk. I'd thought nothing of it at the time, but with the burn of the let-down breast milk, Delphi was due to wake up for a feed, I seized the opportunity and expressed some milk into a saucer. Pushing from the top of my breast to the nipple, milk spraying. I placed it as close as I could to the bed where the copperhead hid. After about half an hour, Alligator started to growl, and the hair on his back bristled. He raised himself up, ready to pounce, his growl low and menacing. Then I saw the snake's head under the bed, and it slowly slithered over to the saucer of breast milk. I stood as steadily and as quietly as I could, clutching the stick that Danny had earlier. I went to whack the snake with it, but the dog got in the way. Took the blow on his nose, poor old alligator. Tough old bastard, didn't flinch. He caught that snake, shook it silly, snapped its back. Danny is so proud of his hero dog. I stop my reminiscing, smile and give Danny's hand a gentle loving pat, giving him reassurance that my frowning is nothing. He scampers off again. That one is special. My angel, I call him. He's my little soulmate. This winter he's supposed to be getting his Dar's boots, but I'd love to be able to buy him a brand new pair. He deserves it. He's seen so much. I've tried to shield him, but there's only so much I can do. The children love our walks. We make up yarns and see who can spin the best story for the longest time. Danny's pretty good at it. So am I. Gives the children a chance to ask me questions about my life. And for some reason I open up, tell them what I know and don't know. If they were to ask me these same questions around the house, I'd close them down quick smart. Out here, it's open space and open mind, maybe. I talk about things I learnt from my Da and from the life we lived and what I did as a child. Walking was one of them. Lots of walking. Me and my Da would walk almost everywhere. He worked at various jobs, a jack of all trades, and we walked to where the work was. I loved it, and I miss it. It kept things lively, because we'd meet people along the way, or when we managed to get a lift in a passing wagon or a peddler's cart, we'd get to talking, hearing their stories, the short and long of them, learning to decipher the lies from the truth. We'd share ours, not a lot of detail, just what Da wanted them to know. And let me tell you, he was an expert at spinning yarns and keeping them going. "Your mother?" they'd ask quizzically, looking at me. And Da always replied with, "She died at childbirth. The girl killed her." He'd nod towards me and nothing more would be said. And that's about all I know myself. They'd look at me with sympathy. If it was a peddler who offered us the ride, on hearing my sad Ma's story, he'd often give me a trinket of some sort. "Ma!" It's Joe Jr. He's found another wombat hole. You'd kill yourself if you fell in one. He's always on the lookout for me, just as well. I'm so in my head today, thinking too much on the past. But that's what these walks are for, sharing life's story. I look to my daughter, Delphi, who was skipping ahead, her ringlets bouncing. I set them last night after our wash. She's naturally curly, so I divide the wet ringlets where they fall, twisting them in old bedsheets that have been ripped into strips. I also use these for medical emergencies. Her once red skirt, now pale pink, swishes just below her knees, a big safety pin holding it together at the back. She has a few more years before she'll actually fit the thing. It's from one of Miss Shirley's Christian charity clothing drives. We receive a little package yearly. It's a great help. Delphi is singing to herself in a fine little soprano voice. "Sings like an angel," my Da would have said, singing and skipping along without a care in the world. Ah, without a care in the world. I don't think I ever had a moment where I didn't have to care about something or someone. I worried all the time when I was little, and I still worry all the time, but now I have the know-how to make things right. I don't let my worries affect the children, although Danny is quick to pick up on them. When I was little, I worried whether my Da would die on me, especially when he was drinking. His drunken snores would get caught in the back of his throat and I'd nudge him awake. He'd finish off a snore and then inhale and repeat the pattern all over again. Snore, gets caught, I nudge, he exhales and inhales, and then repeat until dawn. As the sun broke the horizon, his breathing would become even and I'd finally get some sleep. I couldn't help but think at these times, if he did die, who would take me? Who would understand me? Who would want to be bothered with me? I worried when it rained. Where can we shelter? I worried when the sun was shining, but Da's pale skin would burn to a crisp. I worried when I was left alone in the shearing shed sleeping quarters, praying Madar would return that night and not get into a fight that might see him arrested or dead. I worried about the next meal. I worried about where I could go to the toilet. I worried and worried. So to see my daughter skipping without a worry in the world means I've done my job, found my place in this world as a mother, found my peace. I have, because of my children. A burden buried. It'll kill me if the secret I carry down this road today is ever unearthed. Maybe that's why my head is running away with me today. I'm worried about more than alligator being away. I'm a little worried about giving birth, although everything has been going along all right. Nothing different to my other pregnancies that made it this far. But I'm older now, 40 years old. This will be my last. I know it. Saddens me a little. Oh, there's lots to do to prepare. No money and time running out. I shake my head. Sunday walks are to rest the weary and restless mind. I hear Delphi giggle as Danny catches her up and gives her a tickle as he passes. Of course, her other ratbag brother's tickles are slaps, and her peaceful moment turns to torment as they belt the back of her head. But she's a tough one. She might be 5 years old, but she stands up to her brothers. She takes off, giving chase. The dirt flies up behind them. I would run and run. Run for help. Run away when danger was near. Just run when I wasn't sure. Running on my wedding night. Joe too drunk to catch me. But the following night he didn't drink as much and caught me before I planned to leave. My virtue was still intact and our marriage hadn't been consummated. But this night he caught me and took a strap to my ankles. I couldn't have run if I tried. He had his way with me and it hurt, exactly as Miss Shirley said. So I thought of the children, the babies I would have, given love and being loved in return. I wasn't much older than Delphi when I first went to stay with Miss Shirley, the minister's wife. Father McGuinness was older than her by 10 years. She was barren, but her flock was big, is what she would say. She stuck her nose into all the young mother's business, putting them off from coming to church. "The babes are unwell," the poor husbands would lie. I only went to church when I was staying with her. Miss Shirley is what we were told to call her. Her family were one of the first to settle up here in the high country, them and the Edwards, who were still in the district too. The Edwards, big family, lots of land and lots of money. Word is they have something to do with the financing of the old outpost, Crest Hill, which is being turned into a town. That was something Joe did share with me. Not sure what's happening with the idea of the town now, though. Haven't been into town for a while. Need to go. Miss Shirley did look after me properly, fed me and put clothes on me that made me look like a doll. When my dad went away on the droves, that was the only time he left me. Otherwise, wherever he went, I would go. I was a helping hand. Good little worker I was. At one time we worked for an elderly farmer, dar as a handyman and me as a feet warmer and night nurse for the elderly near-blind farmer's wife. I would lie at the foot end of her bed, wrapping myself around her feet to warm them up until her husband got in. I would then move to the floor to a little bed of straw close to the open fireplace. I had a blanket and a pillow stuffed with rags, and I was safe and warm and comfortable. I'd help her through the night onto the commode. "Wipe me, Fenny, front to back," she'd say. I'd pull her nightdress down and she'd lean on me as we crossed the cold floor. I never got into bed when the old farmer was there. I was 10 years old, not naive or silly, wise beyond my years. When I was younger, I would sneak into some of the inns my dad drank at. I'd lie under the table where he sat and believe me, I saw a whole lot of things. Hands and fingers dancing up shirts and skirts, undoing buttons, hands diving in like they were going down a rabbit hole. These lessons held me in good stead. Today I look at my children and wonder what my da would think of them, of me. Would he be proud of the life I've made for them? Shielding them from harm, giving them a home to call their own, and the one thing I never had, the love of a mother. I hope he's proud of me. When I was about 10, once again staying with Miss Shirley and Father McGuinness, in church I would see how some of the mothers would look at their children with deep love and affection in their eyes, how they would touch them, an arm around their shoulders or a gentle hand to their cheek to show they cared. The pampering, the gestures of love and pride with smiles beaming and their faces brimming from ear to ear. Sometimes I'd grab Miss Shirley's arm and put it around my shoulder. I tried to see the love from my da. I guess I saw it in different ways. He'd sing to me always when he was drunk. But it was a song sung so beautifully that he would break down and cry, and then so would I. He sang, "Black, black, black is the colour of my true love's hair." His Scottish accent was thick, especially when he was drunk. But what a fine singing voice. A voice meant to be heard. He sang many a lament and made up a few too. There was a wee lass called Molly who always wanted a dolly. She said, "I have a name for when my dolly came, and the name I shall call her is Mary." Singing over and over we sing, singing over and over we will. I often wonder if he was singing about my ma when he sang about black hair, because mine is a blondie brown with a tinge of red. My da showed me he loved me, because when we were low in food and our last meal had to be the fat and pan juice from the last piece of meat from the night before, the dripping spread over a piece of dry and sometimes mouldy bread, he would let me eat first and have the freshest piece of bread. Or he would say, "Special tonight, we'll toast that darn dry bread." He cared because he never burnt the toast. But today we walk, every second Sunday since Danny was born, and the children are content to run ahead playing some sort of game. Who can see what first, like a white brumby in a herd, or a boulder that looks like a mushroom, or guessing what the person has seen with only the first letter as a clue. This helps with their schooling. Today I am left to my own thoughts. Children know the paths we take. We toss a piece of bark, rough side for the right, smooth for left, and toss it again to head off from the front or back. I look down at my 7.5-month pregnant belly, rub a hand gently over it. Not long now. Number 5. To survive, I hope. My 10th pregnancy. 4 consecutive miscarriages, varying in 1 to 2, 3 years apart. My last loss was at 24 years old, and then nothing for 4 years, and then finally Danny arrived and survived. That's why I call him my angel. If he died, they would have been putting me in the ground beside him. I would have taken my own life. Life was too much on many levels. Joe Jr. would ask, "Tell us those trials and tribulations," is how he would say it. "Ma, please?" He's heard them stories many times. They all have. But that's what life stories are for, to be told and retold, to remember. The memories living on long after you're gone. Family history. He was away for 18 months once. I think it was one of his Queensland droves. He being my new husband, Joe Johnson, your father. I never called Joe Johnson their da. Always your father. I was 16. He was 36, I think. 3 months pregnant when he left. Our first drove as husband and wife. My da dying, died. I buried him. The same gin helped me. Cried a river, she did. Wailed like the howling wind in a storm. She frightened me a little. But there was also a beauty and comfort to the sound. It's not like she knew him. But I guess she did, thinking back now. Not long after, Jack was born, their oldest brother. Joe Jr. likes hearing about him. Danny doesn't. Maybe because he wants to be his ma's first and only big boy. Jack died, 6 months old. I rode for 19 miles looking for help with my dead son in my arms. buried him too. God, I loved him. Then my two cows died. I truly was alone then. My Di and Da, Jock Stewart, arranged the marriage. Da knew Joe Johnson from when he was a young fella who would drove with Jock. It was a marriage of convenience. Da was hoping it would give me some semblance of social status and the children I so desired. He'd sat me down to tell me of his plans. He did. Sober, but coughing up blood into his handkerchief. He knew I wanted children, so I could know unconditional love. I'd often spoken of not having brothers or sisters, and he knew I didn't like being on my own. I don't want my children to be alone. I want them to have each other, should anything untoward happen to me. Oh, dear me. Must be my hormones. Today I'm thinking thoughts I haven't thought of in a long time. Is the pressure getting to me? Can I keep the facade up? As long as we have no visitors to the property, which is very rare anyway, or anyone asking too many questions, I will be fine. We'll be fine. We'll play the game who can spin the biggest yarn and keep it going. It's not a lie, just a game we play, which I am good at, learnt from the best. And then before long, I haven't thought about the ending yet, but something will come to me when it's needed. I think good when I'm under pressure. My Joe stands 6'5", a mountain of a man, just like the country that surrounds the shanty. He isn't ugly by any means. When we first met, I cringed at the sight of the bulge at his crutch. Miss Shirley warned me about that as well. When I started bleeding, my dad took me to stay with Miss Shirley for the week. She informed me of all things woman. What was required to survive a marriage, what it was to be a good wife, how I should serve him. I remember asking, and what does he have to do in all this to make it nice for me? She didn't answer. I tried to convince my dad that I didn't need a man to keep me safe. I was very capable of taking care of myself, thanks to him and my upbringing. Although I might change some things, but overall, my life's journey had made me who I am. I did understand my dad's position on wanting me to marry. I didn't want to admit it, but I knew he was dying. So I agreed to give him peace of mind, but only on the condition that I get a proper working stove. A few days later, there was a proper working stove sitting in the huge River Rock chimney, and it was Joe Johnson who brought it. I stood back under the old snow gum out front, peering around its edge, ducking back when I thought he was looking over at me. He carried it into the shanty, knocking the wall down in the process. You didn't have to do too much to knock the wall down. God only knows how it was staying upright. It was so flimsy, our two-room home that Da won in a card game. He was always promising to fix it, but he never did. He tried, but he was just too sick in the end. Joe worked on it when he was home, but it was up to me to find ways to fix things. Once Joe had installed the stove, he lit it for me. By this time, I was standing in the shanty, partly behind the curtain that divided the two rooms. I think maybe we were flirting, but that was the only time I ever actually felt attracted to him. So I guess that was something. What would I know? I had no one to ask. Looking back now, it must have been nature. I was to cook my kangaroo stew and damper, my special, and he was to stay and eat. I was taught how to hunt, kill, skin, gut, cut and cook. Da didn't make me drag it home, thank goodness, because the bloody animal was bigger than me. I knew how to do this by the time I was 7. Da made me. He said, "If the good Lord should take me, I know ye can kill and cook yourself a meal." I lived tough with Joe. He wasn't affectionate. Didn't talk much, and I felt more at ease with our marriage when he was away. I tolerated our relations because I knew it would bring me children. And my dad was right. Being married did give you status. You were someone's Mrs. Joe Johnson, my Joe, a drover's wife. Being a drover's wife gave you a higher status to those who knew the drover's way of life. Many of the Sundowners who came looking for work or for a slice of bread would hear your story and move on if you couldn't feed them. No hassle, knowing you was a drover's wife. But there would always be one or two rogue swagmen. They were the bastards who were sick in the head, came at sunset demanding a bed. They'd never done a good hard day's work in their life. Still, I preferred Joe being away. He drank a lot, beat me, had his way with me, left for work. That was our routine. Thank goodness he worked a lot. And thank goodness he had another sexual outlet with a willing woman to the west. It helped ease my burden of going to bed with him. Usually he would satisfy himself before he went away for work and after on his way home with the willing woman to the west. I didn't give a damn. There was one day I did, though. The squabbling of the children brings me back to reality. They're arguing over who's won the race to the turnaround point. Feels like we've only just started. My mind has raced away, all the way, robbing me of this walking day. I haven't even taken in the beauty of the landscape I never tire of. The tall young mountain ash trees, straight and strong. At the base of them are the young wattle trees waiting to bloom again in early spring. Away off now. The end of autumn isn't far away. The ghost white and silver of the tree trunks, the olive green of the shrubs beneath, and the many autumn colours in the dry foliage. A rainbow of red, brown and orange litters the ground. Just beautiful. Never ceases to amaze me. The squabbling has escalated. Enough, I hear myself say. Enough now. Then the race is on again to see who can beat each other back to me. Delphi has started running before they have finished the thought. She's a smart girl for her age. And I finally offer up some play and run towards her, my arms outstretched. She falls into me. She wins, to the boy's dismay. Time for us to head back. There's more rain coming. It's a while off yet, but it'll be here. It's the last of the autumn showers. So glad this morning there was sunshine. We've been indoors for days now. We needed this walk. Is that why my head's so full of all these thoughts? Being closed indoors with only walls to look at, screaming restless children, bickering and fighting. Nowhere for my thoughts to escape to. Just watching the rain washing away my attempts to plug up the gaps in the walls. Getting wet sitting at my kitchen table, inside my home. Joe's been gone 3 months now. Low on supplies, low on bullets. Not a good predicament. I'll let those thoughts go. And think about them the day after next. Because tomorrow is wash day, if it's not raining. The life of a drover's wife. I let my thoughts dissolve on the lonely track. Hopefully they'll stay put. Be gone. Come on, you kids. With my eye, I see something beginning with B. B-B-B-B. B for baby, offers Delphi. Yes, I say. Good girl. What should we call her? Danny pipes up. Me and the boys reckon Molly if it's a girl and Matthew for a boy. I nod, considering. Delphi chimes in. I want Daisy for a girl and Digby for a boy. Where did you get Digby from? I ask. Our graveyard. The grave of the dead cat. The boys laugh and make silly comments about the dead cat coming to life and chasing the baby. Digby was a wild ginger tabby cat I found. Well, it found us when we moved into the shanty. Or maybe it was already living there. I can't remember now. But it died not long after Dar died, and I buried it in the family burial plot with my Dar and a memory stone, a river rock for my ma. My turn, yells Delphi, allowing her voice to soar over her brother's nonsense. With my little eye, I see something beginning with T. That's easy, says Danny. Tree.
Chapter 3.
The City of London never really sleeps. And on this night, Louisa Clintoff is restless. I wake before dawn, excited, scared. How could anyone sleep? I turn over to see my handsome husband and gorgeous son doing exactly that, and it brings a smile to my lips. Samuel has slept between us, his cot and room all packed for the move. The big move, as my mama calls it. My papa calls it silly. Don't you know we are in the middle of a global economic depression, and we are travelling halfway around the world to the country that is worst hit and where it all began, Australia. An adventurer and risk taker I am, and with the Australian Victorian government guaranteeing our safe passage and Nate desperate to find a career opportunity in something more than administration for the British Army, we have to go. I slide as quietly as I can out of bed and go into the kitchen. Our housemaid, Clara, isn't here to nudge me awake, a warning before she opens the blinds. Her work with us is finished now. She cried so much when we said our goodbyes. I'm sure the River Thames rose an inch. Clara had been with me since I was about 8 years old. That's when Mama and Papa's business and political interests really took off, and had them travelling all over Britain. Clara is a dear, true friend and carer. She's only 8 years older than me. A big sister is how I treated her. It was Clara who reminded me of her place, and that I had an older sister. My blood sister, Hannah, older by 3 years, was sent to live with my mother's older spinster sister. Aunt Bethany fussed over her when she was born, nursed her, bathed her, took her for long walks in the park. People honestly thought Hannah belonged to my aunt. When Hannah was 5, Mama could see the strong bond between them, so much so that she decided to send Hannah back with Aunt Bethany for a little holiday. The holiday was constantly extended. In her letters to Mama, Aunt Bethany spoke about what a great help and treasured companion Hannah was. I think back now, and perhaps we should have asked Hannah what she wanted or what she thought about her situation. She did come back for holidays, but she was distant from us, whether out of resentment or because she had succumbed to our aunt's reclusive ways. Mama always said that Hannah was a lot like her older sister Bethany, long before she went to live with her. It was those hermit habits that also led to Hannah's early death. I can't help but blame myself for not trying a little harder as we got older to bond with her, to let her know that she could share things with me, as sisters should, or connect with her so I could see the signs that she was not safe in her marriage. Mama said we can't change what happened to Hannah, but we can make damn sure it doesn't happen to others. Hence our work for the women's movement for battered wives. The whistle of the kettle makes me jump. It's so loud that its echo bounces around the bare room. Swiftly, I lift it from the flame and pour steaming hot water into my little green teapot. 3 twirls to the right, then 3 twirls to the left, a trick for a quick, strong brew. Then I pour the hot black liquid into my favourite teacup. I only ever use 1 cup for my tea. A squeeze of lemon, and then I walk out to enjoy, for the last time, my garden. My small courtyard garden is my favourite place. I'm not a gardener in the true sense of the word, but I do appreciate the beauty and scent of a flowering plant or tree. Planting the garden was Elizabeth's idea. She is my very best friend. We were born 7 days apart. Our mothers were acquaintances, but it wasn't until 4 years after our births that we met in a park and got playing, and our mothers got talking, and we have been best friends ever since. Lisbeth and I told people we were twins, 7 days apart. Lisbeth is much more girly and romantic, while I am the tomboy and the realist. We balance each other. My garden is a mismatch of self-sustaining plants, the kind that just need the odd watering and pruning, like the climbing rose bush I have in one corner. Finally, it's worked its way up to cling to some wire Nate placed on the side wall. I can't help myself. I must sit down there amongst my plants, since it will be the last time for a long time. I sit on the bottom step. There are lavender bushes to my left and right, and daisies that I planted in memory of my grandmother, whose name was Daisy Margaret. She was the topic of my first published poem. Daisy Margaret. A young lady of grace and beauty, a mother of pride and joy, a grandmother of care and comfort, a great-grandmother sick and dying. A young lady of health and beauty, a mother who didn't indulge pleasantries, no ill will or lie. A grandmother to set examples, a great-grandmother sick, in pain and dying. A young lady I did not know, a mother of activity I did not see, a grandmother as I know her, a great-grandmother I see, sick, in pain and dying. Papa thought the poem was morbid, but Mama could see my maturity and potential. She rewarded me for my efforts and ran it in their newspaper. I was 10 years old and very dramatic. My parents, Dawn and Reginald Lawrence, are publishing proprietors, both writers for the publication they print, both progressive, left-wing revolutionaries who are solely responsible for my views. The apple did not fall far from the family tree, believe me. Their strong focus on women's issues features heavily in their work. It was a focus for them before Hannah's death, but her passing drove them to greater involvement. I can't help but think they too felt a little responsible. My feistiness comes from Mama, my drive from Papa. Well, them both, really, but it was Papa's persistence that got their business up and running. And my social conscience is from them both. I have always been enthusiastically interested in my parents' work. At first, it was the physical labour of printing the paper that had me wishing to follow in their footsteps. I respected them both deeply for the hours they put in then, and still do to this day. The technology of the late 1880s and early 1890s has made things easier for them, but Papa is getting on. He's not a young man anymore. Mama has always been an active participant in the women's movement in Britain. She writes about women's education, women's economics and legal rights, battered women and the temperance movement. After losing Hannah at the hands of her husband and enraged at the silence around such a dangerous epidemic, we took it upon ourselves to publicly shed light on the subject. I hope to bring the same awareness to the women in the high country of Australia. My plan is to give them a voice through my own publication, a monthly women's journal that will focus on the gamut of issues that affect a woman's life, from hard-hitting interrogation of education, childbirth, economics, and battered wives syndrome, to the more genteel subject of poetry, knitting, and cooking. I will call it The Dawn, after Mama, that name also being my sister's middle name. Hence my added excitement for our Australian adventure, setting up my own business and actively engaging with the local communities of the region. I have clear and precise goals. So much so that I'm taking one of Papa's old mimeographs, plenty of wax paper and bottles of ink. In the corner of my eye, I see the orange of my various chrysanthemums. I turn to them, thinking the sun has broken out from behind the cityscape and the smog. The assortment of colours was amazing when they first came to bloom. It was as if a rainbow had landed in our garden. What joy they brought. Just what Nate needed in his life. Colour. When we were first courting, we would sit for hours on Saturday mornings in the garden before my plantings, drinking tea, nibbling on fruit and talking as we got to know each other. I respected Nate so much when he finally spoke to me about his dark place. I remember asking him what it was like. He took a moment to find his words, then said, "It was like walking with each step weighted behind your larger-than-life shadow. And when you try to get ahead, you trip over your own feet and land heavily, always face first. There's a constant compression in your chest, shallow breaths, heart racing like it's jumping out of your body." I couldn't imagine Nate ever having to deal with this. To look at him, other than his limp on bad days, you just would not expect him to have this torment. I have only ever witnessed its grasp on him once, and it broke my heart. But we clung to one another and promised that patience and love and time would get us through. And it has. I have asters in my garden because of something I read. that in ancient times the burning of their leaves would ward off evil spirits. I thought they might help Nate and his dark clouds of doom. The aster is supposedly a talisman of love and patience, and patience is what we both know is required for our marriage to last. Love we have in buckets, but patience for each other's little bouts of acrimony, because we can both be strong-headed fools at times, is greatly needed. We have been together for 5 years now and have learnt very quickly when that patience is needed. At those times, I go into the garden and pick that very flower to place around the house. The asters are blue, like Nate's eyes, and their scent is light and breezy, like his nature on a good day, which is most days. The flower I planted for myself is the white columbine. It feels like it belongs in a fairy garden, with its little bell-shaped flower when it is closed and its layers of elegant petals when it's open. Delicate and divine femininity is what I see in this flower. Not quite how I would describe myself, but I planted it as a balance for me. And what else? Oh yes, geraniums. I have two colours, a pink and a red, which I adore. I remember a night when we sat out here in the garden, taking in its heavenly scent. By this stage, we were a year into our courtship, and our marriage was only weeks away. It was the garden's first bloom and planned for our wedding. I'd had a little wine to drink at lunch with a few of my friends, and Lisbeth teased me about the magic that lives in my little garden. "Beware the full moon tonight. Be very careful, Lulu," she said, giggling behind her handkerchief, her eyes dancing with mischief. Nate had chosen to give up drinking, which was a blessing for his melancholia. So on this night he thought I was quite the act. But he was very patient. See, I was very tempted to give over to my great urge to feel his manhood inside me. I get this talk and these thoughts from Lisbeth, you know. Well, I can't really blame her. Let's say she liberates my thinking. But ever the gentleman, Nate sent me home. Even though the thought of intimacy drove him insane, a splash with cold water was what changed his mind and mood. As for me, a spoonful of a concoction my mother had made up that cured everything and stripped paint off walls, a bucket and a cool wet washcloth, and the room beginning to swirl changed my mind of any thought of tomfoolery. We did become intimate before our wedding night, though. You can't blame me. Nate is a strikingly handsome, broad-shouldered man with muscles rippling in every part of his body, one of those men who are just naturally well-built and retain muscle, even if they haven't done a bit of physical exertion. He has piercing blue eyes that penetrate your very soul, and a way of looking at you. Those brilliant baby blues turn into azure puddles of innocence, like a little puppy. I instantly said yes when he asked for my hand in marriage. I thought I owed it to him and myself, considering I had him chase me for 6 months, saying no to every invitation he offered, to functions, dinners, breakfasts, lunches, and walks in the park. He would come to our business and take out ads for the military. My father refused him the advertising space at first, but then the money was too good to pass up. I'm sure Nate put his own wage into the offer. And his argument was that my father must allow the military to have their say, as they allowed him to have his. It was only a recruiting ad, and my father understood the need to defend one's country. He's against us going out and being the aggressors of war, and against the gains the country makes from war, like the South African Boer War, for example, the gold and the diamonds. But when Nate came to take out his final ad, he said it was final because if I did not start courting him, he would burn his house down and move to the country. This time he made sure I couldn't say no. If I didn't accept his invitation to a picnic, besides burning his house down, he would place an ad in my parents' paper stating all the times I had said no to him. It was more for the safekeeping of the house than the embarrassment of the ad that I said yes. Lisbeth and I had followed him one Sunday afternoon to see where he lived, and I fell in love with the modest Victorian two-story house. It wasn't too large or arrogant in its appearance. It was homely, and something about it appealed to me. And Lisbeth said if I didn't say yes, she would ask him to court her. So I said yes, and have not regretted it for one second. Oh, all these precious memories coming back to me. Key moments in our journey together. And now, as scary as it is, we are about to embark on our next chapter in another country. At the height of a global economic depression. Maybe Papa's right. We really are silly. The morning sun will soon be rising over dirty, dusty London. We live in the Royal Borough of Greenwich, on the very edge of the boundary, just before the big bend in the River Thames, where the Isle of Dogs protrudes on the opposite side. Nate inherited the house. His brothers opted for the countryside with their wives and children. On Nate's father's retirement from the British Army, his parents also headed to the countryside, closer to the grandchildren. This was long before I joined the family and our son Samuel Adrian Clintoff was born. Nate's parents are still very active in the army, mainly attending functions and charity events, and often reside with us when they are in town. I do love London, and I will miss her greatly. Especially my garden and my star jasmine, evergreen, its ovate leaves claiming my back wall that borders a back lane, the vine's density covering the mouldering sandstone, and its sweet, soft-scented little white flowers so pleasant in the spring and summer months. When I first moved into the house, it was very much a bachelor's pad. Nate only used half of it. Sparse furnishings, curtains always closed. When we first met, he was in a dark place, as he calls it. It was after our wedding. Well, actually,